It is true that we have not found an effective way to finance the oil deficit, and that therefore the what might have been a blessing is pretty close to a curse, and that is the fact of a very excessive price for oil in the hands of relatively primitive nations who really don't know how to use it, because it would have been impossible to levy a capital tax on the world, on the industrialized world. And yet, the OPEC countries have successfully done that. The only difficulty is that now that they've levied it, they've hid it in the mattress instead of utilizing it for the development of the developing countries, where it could put the world into a burst of productivity which would last for 50 to 100 years. And one of the big diplomatic triumphs will be one day when we learn how to get that done with these OPEC countries, who are sitting on tons of money and just sitting on it, like they were a company treasurer looking for where they could earn an extra half of 1%. I sketch those things briefly. There are, I'm sure, many others, but those are some of the things which bedevil the present economic situation, which make me say what I do. Those and other things, which we'll mention some of, which deal with the fact that we have not gotten on top of much of the structural difficulty which we face in dealing with the American economy. Now, the program that that I will lay before you is far from original, but it is an effort through eclecticism to choose some of the means for doing a better job economically than we are doing. And the first thing I'd like to deal with is a tax cut. Now, I am for a tax cut, and I'm for it now. It's not likely to happen immediately, and it's not likely to happen even in the post-election congressional session, unless things get worse than they are, because the general theory now is, well, maybe things are coming back a bit, and we're out of the worst of this particular recession. If we're disappointed in that, you may very well have a tax cut in the session beginning November 12. But probably not until the new Congress and the new president. So in my judgment, that is still remains an issue. Should we or should we not have a tax cut? And should we or should we not have it now? I believe we should have it now, provided it is a tax cut which will accomplish what needs to be accomplished, to wit, it will fire the modernization or the reindustrialization, as it's now being called, of the American industrial system. And I believe that that tax cut should be divided, and this is probably further ahead than most of the people who want a tax cut, 50-50 between business and the individual. The tax cut which I have in mind comes to a basic figure of what has generally been discussed, something in the area of $30 billion. I believe that half of that tax cut, however legislated into effect, I prefer accelerated depreciation as the standard. Should be devoted to encouraging the modernization of the American business machine. And accelerated depreciation has the advantage of being flexible so that you can give higher acceleration to what you want to encourage. And I believe in encouraging not only the modernization of business or the industrial machine where we have the worst problems of lack of productivity, but also to encourage greater efforts in areas where we have serious economic problems. And among those areas would be the Northeast and this very state in which we speak today, that is the state of New York. Now, the estimate for that particular item is probably in the area of $10 to $15 billion. You've probably heard a lot about 10-5-3. That is accelerated depreciation for machinery and equipment for buildings and for rolling stock. The Finance Committee has reported such a bill with some other approaches than the rather simplistic 10-5-3. But the idea is the right one. And however we might work the problem of selectivity in terms of the particular kinds of modernization which we wish to encourage. As to the personal side of the tax cut, I believe that we need to make up for the rise in Social Security taxes, which will come to about $9 billion beginning in 81, that is calendar 81, and to take account of what's called the bracket creep. That is the fact that income tax rates go up when you earn more dollars, as you do under inflation, even though you may not have a different or a better standard of living. Indeed, you may have a worse one because they buy less. But nonetheless, you're taxed more because of the progressive rates of income tax. The combination of those two is about $23 billion. So that accounts for the figure which I gave you. In my judgment, the most important element which government can contribute. Now, we are dealing in the Congress with regulatory reform, that is, with somewhat answering the complaint of American business that business is being overregulated and that this is very costly, and trying to balance that with the fact that overregulation is also charged to include safety and health, which is, you get on a very touchy subject there, because in our government, things are done at arm's length. And therefore, industrialists don't feel that they're being inhuman if they want to reduce the amount that they have to spend to deal with safety and health. But the labor shouldn't feel any more inhibited in wanting to insist that safety and health be fully protected. And so the so-called OSHA, that is the Occupational Safety and Health Act, of which I'm one of the authors, becomes a very important battleground from that point of view. But as I'm deeply convinced that its tension, which sustains freedom, it doesn't bother me that you're going to have a big fight about it. The fact is that that's probably the only way in which you will resolve with any degree of fairness for this time, the issue. So in regulatory reform, which deals with the actions of the many governmental agencies like the Federal Trade Commission, Interstate Commerce Commission, and Federal Communications, and Aviation, and so on and so on, there is a need for reform. And as I say, we are dealing with that. That's another element where government can help. Also, where we are deregulating. As you know, we've already deregulated in aviation and trucks, and we're very likely to deregulate in railroads. And that, again, is a healthy sign, provided that you keep before you the need for safety and also the need for adequate service, which is frequently overlooked when you talk about deregulation. The fact is that many communities are being stripped of trucking service because it isn't advantageous to do business there. But nonetheless, it is necessary to maintain the service in order to maintain the population in that area and not have huge demographic shifts based on this particular factor. I only give you those as examples of what's afoot in that field without endeavoring to exhaust the subject. Now, the personal side of an income tax cut, to my mind, really should do much more to encourage investment and saving than to afford more money for consumption. But it is desirable, if we can, to keep the economy relatively level in terms of consumption. It is a fact that the bracket creep, which I have described, and the Social Security and other tax increases, it is believed, will raise taxes, real in the sense of the aggregate tax which the individual pays, by about $50 billion in 1981. And hence, there is a case for some effort to readjust the personal income tax load. In addition, it has a lot to do with morale, too. There's a lot of human dissatisfaction with the size of the income tax load, and we should be forehanded in that, not behind the parade. Now, you've heard a lot in this regard about the Roth-Kemp bill, which is not embraced by the Republicans as a party in terms of what they've done in the Senate, but which does seem to be embraced by the Republican Party candidates, except me and perhaps others like me. But I consider the Roth-Kemp approach to be highly improvident. It calls for a 30% cut in personal income taxes without any assurance as to where the money will go or for what purpose it will be used by the individual. Over a period of 3 years in increments of 10% a year. And it means that in the third year, when the 30% takes effect, the federal revenues will be diminished by $75 to $80 billion. And the theory is that that will be made up for by enhanced business activity, which will result. Well, I think the case respecting enhanced business activity is certainly not being made adequately to convince me and to convince many others, and that all that will result will be a big gamble and a vastly increased inflation, highly improvident to this country. So I was very relieved when Governor Reagan endorsed, in an official way, only the first 10% increment, which covers what I had referred to before in a desirable personal income tax cut to make up for increase in Social Security taxes and what I defined as the bracket creep. And I'm for that 10% period without any commitment to the 30, which I think is highly improvident. Also, I believe that we need to exclude from taxes more of the interest which comes from savings. And the reason for that is to encourage savings, as huge capital requirements will be created by the effort to reindustrialize or modernize the American industrial machine, which capital requirements will not be adequately met by the business tax cuts, which can only be incentives rather than supply enough money to do the jobs which need to be done. We now give an exemption from taxes of $200 per individual for interest earned. I believe that over a period of time, and we'll have to be very careful about how we phase it in. That should go to $500, and that this would be a highly desirable incentive for the American saver. Also, I don't want you to forget that I mentioned the fact that I believe that these tax incentives for a reindustrialization should have a heavy emphasis also in areas like our own, which urgently need to keep business and to attract business. And we are losing out very materially in the competition with the South and Southwest. And we now, rather than they, and for years it was they, not we, need some governmental assistance in order to do something about reversing that flow. Now there is a considerable amount of agitation, even talk about a constitutional amendment to limit federal spending to a percentage of the gross national product. And the figure most usually discussed is 21%. Personally, I'm very concerned about that, though as I was the chairman of the Republican task force out of the Republican senators on this subject, in order to get a package to propose, I had to go along with 21% as an element of a package. But it troubles me very much. I never liked these rigidities built into a tax package. If we haven't got enough brains and enough discipline to do what we need to do in dealing with taxation so that we don't have a tax rebellion by our people, then the rigidity of a standard which ties our hands is probably not going to help us. But there is an enormous amount of sentiment in Congress on both sides for this kind of rigidity. And I do not, I am committed to it in a total program, but I do not wish to forecast how that will work out. But I did wish to mention it to you because it's an important point included in this program. Now the second element of the plan that I'm discussing with you is education and training. The upgrading of the workforce is a critically important element in the economy of the country. We have about 12% of the workforce, which is quasi-professional, and modern demands require double that. And yet, we pay unemployment compensation to many people, and the only requirement is that they be available for and looking available for a job. And what they do with that unemployed time seems to be of no business, of no matter to the government or to their employer. That's a frightful mistake. That time of unemployment should be used for people who have no high school diplomas to get them, for people who have only a certain kind of skill to upgrade those skills. People ought to be just as busy when unemployed as they are when employed. Our business system has not caught up with that, and it's one of its great defects. It should catch up with it because it is so important and so desirable. So, I would invite attention to that kind of thing. But we have an even more practical and an even stronger relationship to our society in the stages of youth in respect to training. It is, as we know, so unhappily true that so many of the kids getting out of high school with a diploma can neither read nor write or add or subtract. And this presents a very big problem. Also a big problem of public order.
7% on the average of youth unemployed. And with those rates of unemployment in ghetto areas going up to 15, 60, and 70%, you can account very quickly for the crime and other instabilities in our society. I believe this is, again, a job that business is uniquely capable of dealing with, and that we must encourage American business to undertake it. We're dealing with a universe of about 4 million youth in an employment universe of about 96 million. We certainly ought to be able to handle that in the private sector. Now, between Hubert Humphrey and myself, we have put some laws on the books to deal with the training of youth. But they don't have nearly enough money. And that's why the private sector, which is so critical in this matter. Also, we have put up some laws to encourage business to hire and train youth, especially underprivileged youth. Right now, an employer can get half a year's salary and a tax credit if he hires one of these younger people, which we have today. Also, I'd like to see a 10% investment tax credit to employer finance worker education and training programs. And I might add there also for the establishment of daycare centers in factories and offices. We have a universe, I'm speaking now in sociological terms, of 4.5 million kids who need daycare slots so their mothers can work. It's one of the big deficiencies of our country that there are not many more, well under a million. The last count I saw was 500,000 or 600,000 of such slots. It is not unusual in other societies for the children to be looked after in the very plant in which the mother works. And there is no reason in the world why it shouldn't be done. And again, I believe that we ought to make it possible by giving an attraction to the employer of an investment tax credit in that regard as well. Also in other educational fields, we need more and more, rather than less and less, college-trained people. And there's something also to be said about the college trained. But in our society, they have to begin to accustom themselves to the fact that working with your hands is not demeaning. This is a very important point because, you know, if you're a geologist or an engineer out in the oil field, you don't wear a clean white shirt and a tie all day. And yet that's a highly professional job. And I think we need a new orientation as to what it means to have a college degree and how it enlarges your own life and your own opportunities without necessarily making you white-collar, blue-serge suit work. And this is critical. So I believe that we have to make better arrangements for higher education. We have just had a little success in that regard. We've just passed and had signed into law a higher education bill which favors low-income people to a greater ability to get direct student loans from the institutions which you attend itself, which are called pay $2,000 a year. Deduct that figure from his income. If it were earmarked and could only be used for college tuition, again, to encourage higher education. And by the way, to encourage private colleges and universities, which are so essential to excellence in the educational system. And of course, we all now know that even governmental higher education does have a fee. They're no longer free when attendance is free. I think that would be a very great thing. Finally, and I'm sorry that I've taken longer than I should, and I'll be doing a minute. Finally, there is the personal side of greater efficiency and greater productivity. What one might call, in a word, enhancing the quality of working life, which is so important if we're going to bring this country to its full at least advance in respect to the potential for greater productivity, greater efficiency, and greater enjoyment of life. In this regard, I am a very great believer in the Labor Management Committee concept. That means, in practice, that in a given labor market, generally a municipality, you organize, generally under a municipal office, a labor management committee, which might be composed of and we have some in the state, I'll give you a city, and you should have a study about that, which might be composed of a given number of labor representatives, often chosen by trade unions, but not necessarily confined to that. Given number of management representatives, and generally with a few government people thrown in because they're very useful for point of reference, or when the group feels legislation might be needed, or some work as an ombudsman and trying to straighten something out of government. It's always useful to have some government people around, generally the mayor. On the municipal level. We had 10,000 such committees in World War II in connection with war production. And the use of such entities fell into complete disuse until a few years ago when between Senator Percy of Illinois, who was essentially a business executive, and myself, who was essentially a business reporter, we revived the idea. Now we have on the books, due to our efforts, a law to give some help to such techniques called the Labor Management Cooperation Act. We have a little money, though we have not had great appropriation. It's there and can be increased. And the theory is that such committees would deal with issues outside the collective bargaining process. For example, recreation, the participation of workers in decisions at the plant level. That's for the moment pass over the board of directors concept. We might call them just participation in plant discussion, limited autonomy. Increasing the danger and difficulty of increasing absenteeism. How often have you heard somebody ask, when would your call together? On a Monday or a Friday? It's not likely to be a very good call. I'm very serious about that. It's a very serious problem. It's 2 days out of five. And that's not a big hole in the productivity of the country. Alcoholism. We have 10 million alcoholics in this country. And peer pressure is one of the greatest ways in which to deal with it. And drug addiction, which is almost as bad. And other concepts which think of a factory as a noisy, crowded, place to work that, like the Japanese, this would be my family. I have to always spend most of the time there. I'll give you an analogy, too. I've been very active in the anti-poverty program. And strange as it may seem, the most effective in anti-poverty program, both in terms of impact on the poverty syndrome and in terms of return per dollar spent, was, guess what? The legal services program. Think of it, the legal services program. Because the poor person had such a surge of confidence when he had the dignity that he had a lawyer to. And that if he was wronged or had some problem, he found he had a redress also. It's unbelievable. And notwithstanding, the efforts of the conservative opposition to knock it down, it is now an established program with many conservatives voting for it constantly and its most ardent support. And there's an analogy.